The Bane Free Radio Hour.
Hi there, I'm Griffin Barber, your host for today's edition of the Bane Free Radio Hour. Charles E. Gannon has always been a storyteller, with his works appearing in a broad range of venues starting in the late 80s and 90s. After a long sojourn in academia, Chuck came back to writing fiction with contributions in shared universes with Steve White and Eric Flint, co-authoring excellent novels in the Starfire and Ring of Fire universes, respectively. His fans wanted more, of course, and Chuck obliged with his own series. The Kane Riordan books, which now number more than 8 mainline volumes, and many more in the Murphy's Lawless Annex, which we are here to talk about today, and Into the Vortex. I'm not sure what the title of that series is, but we'll probably get to it here in a bit. And a Webster Award winner and 3-time Dragon Award finalist, Chris Kennedy is a science fiction fantasy author, speaker, military veteran, and aviator, and small press publisher who has written over 65 books and published more than 400 others. He lives in Coinjock, North Carolina with his wife and is the holder of a doctorate in educational leadership and master's degrees in both business and public administration. Hello and welcome, Chris and Chuck.
Hey, good to be here.
So, hardest question first. What is the coolest aspect of Admiral and Commander for each of you?
I'll let Chris go first.
The coolest aspect of it. Well, I've known about the series for a long time. You know, Chuck came to me early on, you know, when he first had the idea for it, and we talked about it, you know, and so I've known about it for a long time, and I think the coolest bit of it probably for me was the main character that I wrote throughout the series, which was Major Kevin Bowden. Because I got to be somebody almost like me. You know, a lot of times in sci-fi, you're writing, you know, things that you've never seen, never done. You're only just, you know, making it up. But this one character was somebody very much like me. He was a naval aviator, flew bombers off the carrier. That was something that, you know, I was an A6 intruder or bombardier. And so I knew a lot about where his mind would be, which made it really easy to get in and do a lot of the things that, you know, I think a real, you know, bombardier, a real bomber guy would go and do. So that was a lot of fun. Wasn't, you know, somebody that I got to do before for a long time since my first book. So I think that was probably the most fun of it for me.
So for me, before we get on to what I found sort of the coolest thing in this book is to address the wonderful stuff that Chris was talking about, and to say that is, I would love to say that is a case for all of us of happenstance, but it was actually bloody-minded planning. Several years before actually Murphy's Lawless actually got out, we all met. The contributors to the first book at Dragon Con at a brunch one day. And the idea was to actually have everybody around the table create a character that was based on their own life experiences and not in some vague way. One of the things that the Lost Soldiers universe allowed us to do was literally reach back into the 20th and the 21st century and pull people with experience in certain kind of aircraft, certain kind of weapons, certain kind of operational procedures and all the rest, and bring that authenticity into the story. And for my money, that you cannot plan that kind of authenticity, because when we've lived something, there are all sorts of, I'm convinced, little semiotic nuances that linguists could probably, you know, bore everybody but themselves to tears with, that identify the authenticity. That authenticity factor. And the other thing I figured was, how better to get connected with, I think we all figured, was how better to get connected with the character than have them be in so many ways outgrowths of our own experience, if not ourselves. So that was, that's been something that's been a driving force and a sort of core concept to all the Murphy's Lawless books.
Which is a lot of fun when somebody that reviews the book says, well, obviously he doesn't know anything about flying. And you go, well, Yeah, I sort of do. Yeah. I've got 3,000 hours in the air. How many do you have?
Yeah. What I loved was there was a review. Boy, talk about going off the rails, but it's a productive going off the rails. And certainly it's going off the rails on a rant, which is always doubly fun. There was that review, I believe it was, of course, on Amazon, which is not really a review, but a customer satisfaction survey. And they said of all the people writing in the series, right, they say, clearly not one of these people have ever served. And so what I did was I actually then I went around, and now Griffin was a police officer, and I think that's probably like the Marines. Once you are, you always are at some level. And I went around and I found that there was actually more than a century's worth of experience collected in those non-authentic narratives. And I'm not ever one to respond to reviews, but somebody did, and if I was going to, that would be my first. So that's yeah.
I always love being able to crush people with numbers. Just crush them with numbers.
Yeah, and I mean, I like the round number, more than a century. I mean, okay, that's a pretty decent sample size.
Especially when there's only like six people.
Yeah, right. You know, so it tells you something about what their fleeting, acquaintance with these various roles and tasks. So for me in this book, the coolest thing was I got a chance to do something that is, it was, how can I put it? I'm a fan of John le Carré, but I would not read him either to stay awake or to come away with a more optimistic worldview. That's not who and what John le Carré does. Now, that's pretty true to the world he lived and the nature of that spy game. Right. But what I also like about his plots are the sort of the minds behind it and the way they work. And this was the opportunity for me to have what I would call my usual suspect moment, where you go all the way through and you think that the game is going in one direction, and only in the last 10% does the onion start unfolding and you realize that there was a whole other set of agendas underneath it. In this case, how Murphy was not only going to get away, but get away in such a way that they couldn't find him, and they would not, and in not finding him, they wouldn't be ruining their own situation back with the spin dogs. So the way I got a chance to play that out, and given the way the novel was sort of split between very much the Bowden sections and the Murphy sections, really allowed that to take place. So for me, that was kind of the coolest thing, because you don't often get a chance to do that in a book. And it was somehow easier to do having another voice in the book. I mean, you can try to do it with your own characters. When you know you've got somebody else in the book, there's this, it created just a different dynamic that really worked for me.
Watch this hand while the other hand.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't look at my toe.
Little Ledger Devane.
Or prestidigitation.
So you've clearly answered
my next question, which was stumbling on the aspect or not. So clearly we've been planning this out for a while. But for those not familiar with the series, Admiral and Commander has a large cast of characters, each with a fairly extensive history already in print. Was that a challenge, or did it make it easy to pick up and work with those characters?
Well, Chuck? I guess I'll go first and simply say, for me, it's very easy. I mean, one of the things is, so I'm involved in sort of the how fitting for me to say, the strangest role, which is not really so much that of an editor, although I will do that too. But in general, I'm working with copy, like for instance with Chris. There was, editing barely required, and really that's not any sort of qualitative thing. That's sort of like, yeah, but I know that this is how it's the way Eric Flint would sometimes change my copy, which was essentially because there were pieces moving in the universe that I wasn't aware of, and there were better handoffs and things like that. And so that's all that I had to worry about in this one. And that's like, that's a dream. You know, I it would be embarrassing to tell you just how fastly this novel got knocked off. But that's because when you work with somebody like that, that's how they roll. So for me, going back to all the characters, none of them are to me what they are to the individual authors, which is in the case of Chris writing Kevin Bowden and all the people who sort of become his group, which were established across, really, when you get right down to it, all the three preceding novels.
Right.
There are people that Bowden knows, they have similar flight experiences. I think his biggest pal is actually a Vietnam era law soldier. I think he was a thud pilot, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
Yeah. Yeah. So for those out there who don't do any mil speak, that would be I think it's an F-105 Thunder Chief. Is that the designation, the thud?
Yeah.
So he's got, and also the hound dogs, or rather the rock hounds and the spin dogs now in this book sort of being conflated into the hound dogs because Elvis. And so for me, it's sort of like old home week. I know all of them, but I don't, my ownership of Murphy is not as, he's a very fun character to write, but I don't, but at a certain level, I actually was able to go outside myself in a bunch of ways for that. So that's a little bit different for me, but coming home to play with all these other characters, and I'll tell you who I had a huge amount of fun writing in this was Vat. because certain things, I got a chance to play with certain things about him and how he would become a very, very essential character as the unfolding of a mystery went on in this particular novel.
Well, from my part, I, as the publisher, I've been involved with all of the stories from the beginning too. So I'm, you know, at least passingly familiar with all of them because I've read them all several times in most cases. You know, so I knew the people. And by the time we got to Admiral and Commander, you know, it was pretty much for me just down to my guys and in my inner circle. It was more challenging to do Mission Critical for me when I was having to play with Griff's guys and Mike Mass's guys and you know Mark Wandry's guys and you know who are probably some of the darker of the ones and with the more spotty past and to be somebody very opposite you know from where Bowden is you know Bowden wasn't a bad guy. He just had an accident.
Right.
Killed a lot of people, but he wasn't a bad guy mostly.
Right. So
I don't see Bowden as a bad guy at all.
Yeah. No, he wasn't. He just got vilified by the press.
Well, yeah, because somebody had to pay
which wrecked him.
That bad intel or incomplete intel or whatever the case was,
right.
Had to put a bomb in a place that it probably shouldn't have gone.
The video got out.
Yes, right. So somebody has to go under the F-16 bus. And
that yep. was yeah, some that was, somebody had to go down for it. And that yep. was him.
Yeah, absolutely.
So along those lines, which character in Admiral and Commander may have surprised you?
I'll let you take that first, Chris.
No, go ahead. I mean, I didn't really have a surprise in most of it. I think some of Murphy's stuff surprised me a little bit, just how he kind of did things and what was going on, even though I knew ahead of time what was going to happen, you know, some of the wherewithals and wherefores and stuff. It was like, oh, okay.
And you checked anybody?
It's in the course of this. Actually, there were two people who surprised me. One was Nellerius, who is the spin dog physician, because one of the things, and I'll bring her up later because I know there's a question coming she is a person with is a person with a lot of unfulfilled desires, longings that existed before Murphy and the Law Soldiers showed up, but they created a shape. one of the things about being a physician, of course, is that a certain degree of compassion is advisable and very often leads to success, particularly if you're not in a narrow specialization, but you're having to operate across a broad client base with a broad number of problems. And so here you have this individual who's always felt the lack of music, the lack of romance, the lack of things, beauty for its own sake. This is not something that this very understandably austere culture has coming from Couture roots really has much of. But then the lost soldiers show up. And then she's the one who sort of is the one who learns the secret that is now in the series no longer a secret, that Murphy has multiple sclerosis. Although I won't give away where that goes by the end of this book. So she was a bit of a surprise because that part of her comes to the fore and she's realizing it very, very concretely. But the most surprising character for me was Chalmers, because throughout the book, now Chalmers is one of those guys that Chris was saying, kind of spotty past. I think that's a tactful way of putting it. Yeah, I kept on looking for the moment when he would show up more profound, but halfway through, I realized where it was going to be. He is the closest thing they have to an intelligence officer. And he comes at it actually from the standpoint of actual more like CID, Criminal Investigation Division, and interrogation. But he's still the closest thing they have, particularly to counterintelligence. So at the end, when all the other characters who have been so absorbed with really in-their-face tasks and things like that, he and his pal Jax are the ones who actually have been less involved in a lot of the stuff in this book than they have in the prior book. They were very, very central in Mission mm-hmm. Critical.
Without a doubt.
And so they were the ones between both their aptitudes and the fact that they had not had their noses in other critical tasks, that it's Chalmers who basically stands back and says, I can tell you what happened here. I can tell you exactly what happened here, and knowing that it is going to be terribly unpopular. But I didn't know when I started the book that it was going to be Chalmers doing the reveal. And for me, it felt good. I hope the thing I worried about is people going to say, well, who was this guy? I saw his name, but he wasn't really, you know, who was he? He wasn't that important in the book.
Where did he come from?
Yeah, right. Exactly. But the book, I think, would make so little sense anyhow if you were reading it without reading any. You could read it.
Yeah.
You could read it on its own, but you miss so much right. with that. And you know there's huge backstory. So anybody who would have known Chalmers would have, you know, I think that this was, for me, this was the right shoe to drop with the big reveal.
Right. And you get to reward your readers that have, you know, gone through it. They're gonna be like, okay, cool. Now, oh, I'll get it now. That makes sense that he's the one who kind of twigs to what might be going on. So in a similar vein, which character from Admiral Commander would you want to avoid like the plague and why?
Chris?
Honestly, there really isn't anyone that I wanted to avoid. I mean, you know, most of the stuff where I was focused, even the guys that start out as difficult are eventually brought into the fold. So, you know, it's less a, you know, I hate that guy, you know, and there's a couple that are, you know, out there, but, you know, they finally realize, okay, you know, we need to do this, and they become, you know, I guess all of Murphy's Lawless, you know, is about redemption arcs. And even the hound dogs have redemption arcs too.
Yeah.
And you, Chuck?
For me, I can't remember her name, but it about the midpoint of the book, the bads, the Culshans, I don't think we're giving anything away there, who are sending the Harvester fleet, which is the core dramatic driver. I mean, And although I don't like the term existential threat because I don't know what we call Camus and Sartre now, but but if they don't beat the Harvester fleet, they're all screwed. Everything is done. And not just in the immediate sense of...
We're all going to die!
Yeah, that's about what the Harvesters and the Colchians would do. Because at the midpoint of this book, when they're getting all sorts of information back from that system and they're starting to put the pieces together and they're saying, we accelerate now. We have a problem. We don't know what it is. Their guesses aren't exactly spot on because 110 to 120 people from a star system we've never heard of that we call or our ancestors called aboriginals arrived in a Dornani spaceship, which we've never heard of across distances we couldn't imagine and just happened to, convince people we didn't even know we're hiding out in that system to help them to take over Rabak.
Not enough Culcean science fiction writers.
Yeah. Well, in this case, I think it needed to be some Culcean doing Culcean mushrooms because the number of impossibilities that are stacked upon each other in that they were never going to come up with the right thing. They were hovering in that idea of pirates who were possibly defected individuals, particularly from the southern continent of Culcean, and that worried them because if it was a politically motivated thing, there are deep hatreds resident in the south continent of Culcis for the northern continent. So this is my long way of saying there is a woman in there who comes from one of the chief family who sits in on this meeting. She's never been at one of these meetings before. That individual, the reason I'd never want to run into her is not because of what she does here, but because I know what she would and is capable of doing. And that is a person, I want my hand on the emergency decompression door, for that for that airlock, and I'm safe on the other side because she's got to go. She's that person on the lifeboat that the first night that everybody's asleep, your conscience is telling you, stick them in the ribs now so they sink quick.
All right. So which character would you want as an ally? This would probably be an easier one for you, Chris.
I want my guy. Yeah. I mean, but I also want the cast of characters, that everybody comes through in the end and, decides, yep, we're going to do this. So let's put all of our effort into it. And, I could not be any happier with how the battle ends and the state of play of all of the people at that point. I'll just leave it at that.
And you, Chuck?
I came at the same answer from the other end of the lens. It's broken out by depends on the situation. There are all sorts of things. On the one hand, I would say your two really straight up shooters are probably and carrying, I don't want to say the least baggage, but I think it's probably it has done less psychological damage to them than the other of the lost soldiers would probably be Bo and Kevin Bowden. Strangely enough, though, I would say that at this point, you could then swing around to the other side. Another ally I would want in certain circumstances is Chalmers, because yeah. Chalmers has made.
I mean, all of them have their place,
but I mean, in the case of Chalmers, his redemption arc came from such a deep place, and it's very clear that it's been the influence of the other lost soldiers. And the fact numerous times in the series, he says, why did he care what Murphy thinks? He's known far more intimidating officers, but for some reason, there's something there. Chalmers is at that point, I think, in a redemption arc where he's like a paladin. He could prove to be a paladin in a situation where everything's against the wall. And I will say this much. If that female character of the Kalshans is a person to get out the airlock as fast as you can, the person who will be on your side without restraint, without measure, without question, Welch might question purposes, but not the loyalty to somebody, is definitely Nalarius. Because once she's in, she's all in, which is why she's been able to make the hop she's made.
And I do agree with what you said about it depends on what, you know, what you're getting into. I can see some applications where Harry Tapper might be really good to have on your side.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, the place I'd want him most is exactly where he ends up. Actually, the one who's going to write some sort of workable constitution or social contract for the group, because he's lived a pretty messy existence, but there's been a sort of dogged core of always asking, but why do we do it? Why do we do it? Why do we do it? And that we didn't have good answers for that back where we came from. Damn it, we have to have them here now. So, yeah, I mean, that's one of the fun things about this, because together it's sort of like you know, the sort of movies where teams come together. It's like, what if you could believe in the A-team? Of course, you have to put them on another planet, but it's that it's that sort of thing that together they are, well,
the synergy. You're going for there. Synergy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Maximum synergy to overcome the odds they have so many times now.
Well, and that's one of the cool things for me about that was, you know, like I know that Masa was, as the writer of Tapper originally, was kind of struggling with, well, why are they doing this? And he raised that question with you. And then it was like, that's Tapper's question. You know, that's Tapper's question. And Mike's like, ooh, that's Tapper's question. And he kind of went with it and rolled with it. And that was really one of the more exciting aspects of this project for me, is watching everybody kind of find that lane and then run with it and then still have it be a cohesive narrative. Is just pretty brilliant there, Chuck. So,
because he's not your stereotypical SEAL either. I mean, you know, which, you know, he's not, he doesn't always go gung ho. He's questioning, you know, what I'm, you know, he's kind of broken about it. And, you know, I'm just done. You know, why do I want to do this anymore? You know, so it's an interesting take on that.
Yeah.
It was.
And the country you took an oath to no longer exists, right?
Yeah.
At least not in that same sense. So, yeah.
I don't know you crap.
Yeah.
And what do you think of me now?
And yet figures out a way, right? And that's one of the cool things with Murphy is, you know, not necessarily massaging it, but giving him the answers to the questions. Hey, and maybe we just table that for now. And since you keep asking that question, why don't you answer it for us? Mm-hmm. So as far as for me as an ally, definitely Murphy. I missed that.
The best CEO answer. Oh, you're absolutely right. Thank you for volunteering.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another Eric Flintism too. I don't know. Write it.
Yeah, there you go.
So as we've said, Admiral and Commander has at its heart the lost soldiers who are just trying to survive and build a life for themselves in a future they had no say in. Specifically, Bowden and Murphy are your principal POV characters. Both are faced with the unenviable goal of finding a way to get uncooperative people, to say the least, to work together to survive. And both go about that obtaining that goal in very different ways. Do either of you prefer one character's methods over the other?
Of the two that you outlined?
Bowden and Murphy, yeah.
Bowden's. Bowden's method is infinitely preferable. The question is, I don't know if Bowden's methods are exactly what you would want in a reliable, moral officer, military officer with integrity that is tempered by a very realistic view of the world. And usually the realistic view of the world leads to being jaded. But but I'm not sure. And this is what Murphy is dealing with. And it's why this, the end of this, this novel was for me very satisfying to write, because the, where Murphy's arc is sort of left in this, has left all the other characters now asking, now what? Because there's now a contemplation of, we all had one thing in common. We could bitch about Murphy. Well,
now what?
Now, maybe not. And guess what? You actually have to find out what his job was like, because you're going to have to do it. And that's, I think, for me. So, but I would prefer, I would love to be in a world where I could do, or in a position where Bowdoin's were the methods that I'd be able to use.
By far. And you're right.
As far as, you know, I see, you know, it's two different leadership styles for two different groups. I mean, in one, Bowdoin is leading a group of like-minded people, you know, doing a, you know, the, hopefully the same thing, getting them to participate if he can. You know, it's a matter of, you know, being very goal-oriented and we need to go do this and here's why, and okay, let's go. And you know, leading from the front, you know, I'll be right there. I'll be at the tip of the spear. I'll be, you know, yes, I'm going to do it too. I'm not telling you. As opposed to someone that's, you know, at the next echelon, that is now the guy that's trying to get a bunch of different commanders, you know, to do something. And it has to be a little, you know, the leadership style has to be a little bit different to be effective. So, you know, it's somewhat situationally dependent. Both of them work, you know, depending on, you know, who you're dealing with and how.
Yeah. Tailoring it to your group.
Yeah. No, knowing the people that you're trying to lead.
Yeah. Read the room.
Yeah.
So this band of unlikely heroes, the Lost Soldiers, they're not so central to this tale as they were in earlier novels. Instead, we get to see more of what the Rockhounds and Spin Dogs are like and how they see the world. Was this something you worked on together to produce in order to give us a different worldview from each of the characters, or something that kind of just occurred?
Well, we certainly knew that both of us were going to be handling different aspects, but the evolution of the Spin Dogs and the Rockhounds into the Hound Dogs was something that, whether even before I think we, those were the names, you know, that fusional name came up, there was no way that this was a house that had long been, was always on the edge of being divided, but in this final hour, it could not be. There was simply no way that this house, if divided, was going to stand.
Not only a house divided between the Rockhounds and the Spin Dogs, but even the Spin Dogs just themselves.
Yes, absolutely. And the Rockhounds, as it turns out, just themselves. Yeah. There are hints in there that, for instance, then there are the Rockhounds that actually have stations that they can put out pods that work as rotational habitats. And then there are the ones who are really living in very low G. And most of the time, and they are changing more and more. So you've got one of the things that it was fun to do with this, which I think we got the opportunity to tease out a lot of the stuff that's simmering under what I would call the big indigenous space side politics. It mm-hmm. was in the first one, it's sort of like, who the hell are these people and how do we make sure they don't push us out an airlock? That was really, that came very close. Mm-hmm. In the second one, you have some continuations of that. But the second, and particularly the third, and particularly this fourth one, one of the parts I enjoyed writing the most is when it is the Rockhounds who say to Murphy, we have something to show you. And he goes, away the hell out, beyond mm-hmm. the ecliptic. And more stuff is unveiled. And you realize that they haven't even begun to scratch the surface of what actually has been going on here and what is still hidden here.
Well, and how old it is.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. You know, from my part, you know, I had to deal a little more with some of the intrigue at the lower levels. because, you know, while Murphy's dealing with the Klan chiefs, I'm dealing with the guys that are taking the treason in the face, you know, the ones that, you know, you're on a ship and one of the people's a traitor. How do you figure out who that is and how do you space them without spacing everybody, you know, and ruining your relationship with the good people, you know, and just about everywhere they've gone, the spin dogs have had people that don't like Murphy, don't like the Lawless, don't like anybody, don't want change, don't want, you know, and are happy, would rather sacrifice some of the long-term stuff just to screw with people now. You know, we don't like them. We're not going to lose to them. They need to go. And okay, that may change how we see things down the road, but we don't care. They have to go. And, you know, in talking with Chuck about, okay, well, what about this? What about that? You know, in getting some of the more intrigue of how things are going at the upper levels, and then trying to play that out, you know, amongst the minions and, you know, who's going to do what to who hates each other, who will not work with each other, no matter what. And then trying to figure out, okay, so you won't work with them. So what do we need to do to make you work with them?
There's a couple of moments that I really enjoyed where, you know, Bowden's just like, okay, bye.
Yeah.
And basically,
I can't deal with you anymore. You're gone.
Yeah. It's like, okay, bye. You won't be in it. Don't worry about it.
Go tell Dad. I don't care.
It was good it was nice to be able to use this as a vehicle to get into concepts such as subsidiary houses and houses that were still looking for affiliations. That this is that, you know, most things when we find ourselves in a culture or a situation or an organization, I think probably there's a human tendency, in addition to the fact that we're just unfamiliar with it, that in order to simplify all the diversity, what we do is we create categories. Right. And we tend to create the big categories first, because that gives us something that's useful, something that's, I'm going to say something odd, mentally tactile, that we can sort of move around in the whiteboard of our conscience and say, this relates to this and this relates to that. And that was really driving a lot. But in this one, and I think and Chris did an outstanding job with it, brought forth the granularity that, you know, that if it was being talked about on the upper levels, Chris made it happen. Chris showed what it was like. Chris showed what it was like if you were, you know, you're underneath this house, you know, you're underneath house with Lathes, but that doesn't mean I'm happy. And that doesn't mean that I shouldn't be in charge. And that doesn't mean that there aren't people in that already sort of disaffected house or family that are sort of getting, you know, well, if you help me, I'll make things really sweet for you when the center of gravity shifts. And I think, you know, Kevin, see how easy it is. Chris absolutely brought that to the fore.
And now we bring you our audiobook serialization of Tinker by Wynn Spencer. Inventor girl genius Tinker lives in a near future Pittsburgh, which now exists mostly in the land of the elves. She runs her salvage business, pays her taxes, and tries to keep the local ambient level of magic down with gadgets of her own design. When a pack of wargs chase an elven noble into her scrapyard, life as she knows it takes a serious detour. Tinker finds herself taking on the Elven Court, the NSA, the Elven Interdimensional Agency, technology smugglers, and a college-minded xenobiologist as she tries to stay focused on what's really important, her first date. Armed with an intelligence the size of a planet, steel-toed boots, and a junkyard dog attitude, Tinker is ready to kick butt to get her first kiss.
Chapter 10. Blind Sight. A gossamer airship was moored over the fairground's now empty meadow. Tinker had seen many gossamers at a distance, but never one close enough to appreciate their true size. Something so huge, living, floating in midair, challenged the mind to accept it as truth. The gondola alone was 100 feet long and 60 feet wide. The gossamer rippled in the wind above it, dwarfing the teak structure, and that was a portion of the animal easily seen. The cell structure of the creature fractured the sunlight into a million prisms, giving substance to the nearly transparent form. The creature's countless frilled fins, extending far beyond the glittering mass, showed only as a distortion high overhead, like water running over a glass roof. How much tinkering did you have to do to get the gossamers that big? I believe getting them large was not the problem, Pony said. They occur in nature nearly that size. Probably making them float in air was the difficult part. Originally, they were sea creatures. Why wouldn't they start with something that already floated in air? You can grow wings on turtles, but they still crawl on the ground. What the hell does that mean? Pony struggled a moment to put it into words. Those that float in air naturally go where the air takes them. They needed something that could choose its own course. A swimmer. It took her a moment to realize he was talking of instinct. You can give turtles wings, somehow, but not the understanding of flight. Yes, Pony beamed a smile. There are some side considerations. Redesigning a body structure to take the stresses of such a massive size and strong currents would have been difficult, so they selected an animal already quite large. Who are they? The Domana. On a single from the wyverns, there was a loud clank above their heads as safety locks disengaged. An ornately carved wooden elevator-like cage smoothly lowered from the gondola. The doors were handmade works of art, and they folded aside to reveal the stunningly beautiful sparrow lifted by wind. Her shimmering white gown of fair silk was cut so far off her shoulders, displaying her pearly skin, delicate bone structure, and full breasts to perfection, that Tinker wasn't sure what was keeping the dress on, except for the fact that it was too tight to otherwise slip down. What kept her from being the antithesis of Hannah Briggs' type black was an overdress of cerulean that drifted around her like smoke and matched the blue of Sparrow's dhow mark. Sapphires, cerulean ribbons, and pale blue forget-me-not flowers waved through her intricate pale blonde braids, not a hair out of place. Instantly, Tinker realized that she was covered with motor grease, engine oil, dirt, and chicken shit. That she wore Oil Can's hand-me-down t-shirt, her worn carpenter pants, and boots large enough for Minnie Mouse didn't help either. Oh, hell, she breathed. Huspavua. Pony bowed in greeting. Tinker started to bow too, but Pony checked her with a hand to her shoulder and a slight shake of his head. Sparrow's eyes narrowed slightly at the gesture, and she flicked her hand dismissively at Pony. You are released from this duty. Take the car and return to the Enclave. I am Zadomi Anis, Pony stressed the plural, guard. I will be going with her. Pony startled Sparrow into showing cold, deep anger that smoothed away a moment later. Come then, Sparrow motioned toward the elevator cage. I am needed at Omra now, and can ill spare my attention for this babysitting run. More than three would have crowded the elevator, so the wyverns waited on the ground while Sparrow, Pony, and Tinker boarded. The doors had to be closed manually, and a bell rung to signal that all was ready for the cage to be raised. Still, the elevator rose as smoothly as it had descended. Sparrow studied Tinker as they rode upward and gave a slight sniff. She smells so much of mud. One would think Wolf, who rules, fashioned her out of dirt. Pony did not bother to hide his anger. You fumbled badly, Sparrow. The wyverns dealt with her in their normal, heavy-handed manner and nearly hurt Zadomiani. You should have accompanied them.
And you should remember, I'm Domana now, not Q-Town. Sparrow chided him. As for the wyverns, she clicked her tongue in an elfish shrug, the fault does not lie with me. No one would expect the wyverns to be stupid enough to attack the viceroy's wife.
The cage slid up into the gondola, and the safety locks re-engaged with a thud under their feet, muffled now by wooden carpet. Sparrow folded back the door to reveal that the cage was tucked into an alcove of a richly paneled hallway.
I have clothes for her. They'll need fitting. First, though, she'll have to have the barnyard washed off her. Go, clean her.
Tinker bristled.
I can speak low tongue quite well, and I'm fully capable of washing myself. Then do so. We have much to do before we arrive at Om Ranao. You must be fit to be brought before the queen. Sparrow bowed curtly and shot a hard look at Pony to collect a bow from him. Once Pony had paid his due to her, she flowed away, a shimmer of white and cerulean. This way, Domi, Pony murmured to Tinker, indicating that they were to get out of the way of the arriving wyverns. He led her down the hallway that cut through the center of the gondola. Behind them, the Gossamer's crew prepared to cast off the moorings. There was an odd unpredictability to the floor that hadn't been that noticeable standing still. It shifted right and left, up and down minutely, so that each stride felt like a misstep. Rooms were carefully balanced off either side of the hallway. The first door stood open, revealing an observation room, all done in creamy white and accents of red, with a bank of windows open to sky. Three elf females sat surrounded with bolts of fair silk, laughing as they worked with the material. They looked up as Tinker paused to glance in at the view, and they went into stunned silence at her appearance. "Pardon," Tinker stammered, and started to bow out of reflex. Again, Pony caught her shoulder and shook his head. "Why do you keep doing that?" she whispered as she fled the doorway.
"You are higher caste than Sparrow and those females," Pony said. "There is no one on board that you should bow to."
"Oh," Tinker pointed to her forehead. "The Tao?"
"Yes, the Tao. And that you are now Windwolf's Domi."
Pony opened a door and stepped into a small room of hand-painted ceramic tiles. The motif was phoenix and flame flowers, a riot of reds and oranges on pristine white.
"This is the bath. Do you wish to be attended?"
"No," she cried, then eyed the room. Having been practically raised by Tulu, she thought she knew how elves bathed, just like humans. The room certainly challenged her notion of this. She recognized the bathrobe hanging on a hook, but there were no faucets. There was what looked like a pull chain dangling next to a spout, but it was at knee level. "This is a bathroom?" Pony considered the question carefully and then nodded.
"Yes."
He leaned into the room. He seemed loath to actually enter it, and lifted up a wooden disc sitting on a wide, waist-high shelf. Beneath it was a large circular tank of steaming water.
"This is the pesh." He replaced the lid. "Bay."
This was a wide, shallow bowl.
"Jiri."
A dried, hollow gourd.
"Safot."
A sponge-looking thing. "Soap?" she said hopefully. Thankfully, there was soap, heavenly scented, in a paste form close enough to bar soap that she could wing it. Pony handed the soap crock down off its shelf, then stood there, distressed.
"I can get an attendant to help you."
"I can wash myself."
"Yeah, sure.
Just, what's the pull chain for?" Pony winced.
"The wash water."
He pointed to the low spout.
"You fill the basin and pour it over you, and then use the soap and the safat. And rinse again, then into the pesh to soak."
"Ah, I see." Seemed a damn uncomfortable way to wash, but she supposed it saved water. No wonder Tulu stuck to human showers. "I can handle it from here."
That was another installment in Wynn Spencer's Tinker, and that's it for the podcast. Thanks as always to Audible.com and podcast theme composer Ruth Judkowitz. And good night, Tony Daniel, wherever you are. This is David F. Shirod coming to you from a soundproof bunker somewhere deep in the heart of Texas. Join us here next week at the hammering heart of science fiction and fantasy, and keep reaching for the stars.